welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life Money Maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. Today, we have our first Swiss guest. Yes, after 71 episodes, we're going to the country originally called Helvetia when Julius Caesar conquered it, a country with one of the highest rates of gun ownership in the world, but one of the lowest crime rates, and today with a population of 8.6 million, the highest density of millionaires in the world. And to gain a different perspective on the developing and changing world of private equity that we've been examining, I'm delighted to have a Swiss physicist with a PhD whose passion is to climb mountains, but whose day job is being responsible for the private equity business of Schroders Capital. So Rainer Ender from Zurich, willkommen heute zu dieser Ausgabe der Money Maze Podcast.
Well, thank you, Simon. It's an honor to be on the podcast and the first Swiss speaker. I'm very excited about that.
I know Switzerland is, of course, known for its neutrality, but we don't want any sitting on the fence today when we're talking about private equity. So we really hope that we're going to get a better sense of Schroders Capital approach to private equity, your perspectives, what's behind the impressive returns, and your focus on the investment segment, which is smaller cap than many of the others we've spoken to and is your sweet spot. But let's start with you. You have a PhD in physics, and that is also a first for the podcast, but you switch or you go to finance. Just tell us a little bit about your thought process.
So basically, I have a PhD in nuclear physics indeed in the late 90s or in the mid-90s. Then was looking for a real job. I recognized that the finance sector needs people who can count. And that's what the physics education was very good at. I was driven by intellectual curiosity, basically, to just do something new and enter the financial services industry when derivatives, pricing, value at risk, capital adequacy, and similar things came into play. I joined through advisory for financial risk management consulting, and after a few years ended up in private equity to also cover portfolio construction and risk management in private equity at the time.
Well, maybe the nuclear industry was your loss, but the financial services was the gainer. But let's just take a 500-foot view of the Schroders Capital business, of which you are one part. And maybe you can just give us a sense of its origins and philosophy.
Schroders Capital, the private asset business of Schroders, is a pretty significant business. It's more than $80 billion of AUM and really has private equity, real estate, infrastructure, and also private debt as its core components, where private debt has a broad range of specialized strategies. And also all the other strategies mentioned are mostly focused on specialized, rather mid-market sized transactions, not the largest, but with specialist local execution. And we can bring that to clients with a high emphasis on solutions and bringing different strategies also together. On top of that, we have a strong emphasis on impact and sustainability, also through a company that is called Blue Orchard, that is part of our business. And in infrastructure equity, Greencoat was our latest announced transaction that has broadened our overall offering space, also with regards to renewable energy and climate as such.
Great. Well, that's very helpful. So let's just go down the next level into the private equity business, which you oversee at Schroders Capital. We've examined a variety of different PE models over the last few weeks, from Goldman Sachs' Peters Hill that takes stakes in the GPs to Bain Capital with their PE and private credit business, CD&R and their long-term approach, and even co-investing in quoted equities in Permira and KKR. But I know that you as a group tend to favor the indirect as opposed to the direct approach. So maybe we could just start with you explaining how that's come about and why that works for you and your clients.
First of all, it's a pleasure to say that we are investors in some of the names that you've just mentioned at the large end of the market. The large end, however, is a pretty concrete universe of managers. You can count them, you know them all, and it's pretty easy to access these managers and work with them for underlying investments. Where the private equity market becomes much more challenging to address is what I call the lower half of the market, which is broad-based in local specialized players, and where a direct approach for a global execution is a very challenging thing. So that's why we've pursued this market coverage through the indirect way, working with local GPs, specialized GPs in the lower end of the market, anywhere in the world, and creating a global portfolio of high-quality investment opportunities.
So one of the things that struck me as I try to understand your business is that there's a specific focus on this lower half of the market, by which I mean, I'm going to quote your words, investing one step below the mid-market. Maybe you could just spend a minute or so explaining the rationale.
First of all, the market gets less efficient the smaller you go. That's pretty logic. It's the same in the public side. And inefficiency is a benefit in itself for new investment opportunities and getting them at attractive pricing. Secondly, buying low, smaller businesses, growing them successfully and selling them upwards is a very efficient way to generate proceeds and to have a good exit opportunity for your investments. And as long as the upper end of the private equity market is performing that well and raising that much money, it's a very good exit opportunity to sell upwards to larger funds.
Well, we're going to talk about a few examples a little later on, hopefully. But one of the things that struck me, and I wasn't sure I either understood or agreed, is that you said there's quite a lot of complementarity to public equity and low correlation. And I was thinking, well, the economic cycles as they play out affect assets, public and private, even with a delay. Maybe you could just explain why you believe that.
The complementarity to public equity in our private equity investment approach is really very key. And we believe we can secure low correlation despite having company equity investments with us. And the reason for that is that we invest in smaller businesses, which, if you start on the venture side, a pre-IPO financing round is very much linked to a public market, and one company may be still private, the other one competitor may already be public, and the valuations will always be pretty relative to each other. If you go to the very early stage, an early stage company is priced based on the quality of the founders, their experience, and the creativity of the business idea. that's less cyclical through the market, and also the money inflows into the segment are less cyclical than at the late stage. The same applies, in our view, on the buyout side, where larger buyout transactions have clearly comparable businesses on the public sector. Therefore, the pricing is very much compared to that one. It's a more similar portfolio. While on the smaller end of the market, you still buy 70% of the deal flow from family ownership. That's less cyclical in pricing. It has less debt financing in the companies, and therefore, again, is less cyclical through the economic cycles and the M&A cycles with regards to the possibilities to buy these businesses at attractive prices. And with that, we also create portfolios that have real content that is clearly different from what the public companies represent. So that's where we believe we can generate an additional component of alpha performance and outperformance over public.
When you are involved in these investments, and they are typically indirect, how close do you get, if at all, to the management teams, to the strategy as it unfolds? Because I obviously understand you're involved in the financing of these. So just help me understand a little bit about where your reach starts and stops.
If you look at our overall investment activity, which is roughly $2.5 billion per year, a bit less than half of that we invest as primary fund commitments. So we commit to the funds of specialist managers around the globe from venture to turnaround. And as I said, mostly funds that are typically smaller than $1 or $2 billion in fund sizes. The other half, we really focus on co-underwriting together with these managers, investment opportunities that they cannot cover on their own based on slightly too big transaction volume for their own funds. So we co-underwrite businesses, and that's where the value add comes, first as a very reliable business partner, as a very responsive partner, but also with a different perspective on the specific company. We have a big portfolio of global businesses in all the industry sectors that we want to look at here. And we can bring a global comparison, global experience of comparable businesses to the local execution that is driven by the individual specialized fund manager in his own space. Can add a bird's eye view on the overall aspect and also broader industry experience from comparable transactions.
Tell me, in what percentage of the portfolio companies would you expect ever to meet management?
That's part of every due diligence where we invest directly. The interaction with management is crucial. And really, what is important for us is we buy into businesses that we want to own at the price we can get them, so like a direct investor, but with a governance model that we feel very positive about, which is driven by our local specialist partner rather than us sitting on the board necessarily.
I'd like to talk about your geographical focus. Everybody knows the Schroders heritage, Europe and the UK. And as I looked at the mix, I think I'm right in saying that around 50% is got a Europe bias and then a third in the US and the rest in Asia. Assuming that I'm correct on that, maybe just talk a little bit first of all about Europe, because in many ways, one could say it's maybe less developed than the US and the UK in terms of the whole private equity operations. Just start there in terms of how you see the European landscape.
We do roughly half of our investment activity in Europe. This is our home market as such, while for many clients, we are really the global solution to invest everywhere. In Europe, the private equity market is less developed than the US market. It benefits especially from the fragmentation of Europe, meaning despite the European Union, we still have individual countries with individual languages, and many business models are more localized in their approach. The big positive potential for European buyouts is to have geographic expansion and consolidation. That's a strong additional element that we can bring into Europe, which in other regions like the US with one large country is less possible. On top of that, the European market is roughly 10 years younger overall. And for a long time, the managers have been geography focused. But this has changed, and we have been a very active driver of that by focusing on industry-specialized managers across region rather than country specialists. The benefit of the specialization is really that they can drive consolidation or the geographic expansion for their specific business models that they support. On top of that, especially for non-European investors, Europe has been a challenge for the last 15 years for sure. First, the Southern European crisis, then the Brexit. Now we have the latest developments in Ukraine. There's always something macroeconomically challenging in Europe. This has been forever, and this makes people a bit reserved. But the interesting thing is that economic growth and performance, financial investment performance, are not in sync. It's not correlated. Therefore, we see more attractive pricing in European buyouts, more fundamental conservative pricing, and still have generated strong performance, often also with international businesses. Italy, for example, mostly has export businesses in private equity. Therefore, the local depressed economy at some times has been a benefit for low pricing, but a fully working business model.
Yes, and of course, dislocation creates opportunity. And we've got one of those epochs right now as we look at listed market valuations and the disparities between UK and Europe versus the US. I'd like to just pause on Asia, because again, we talk about maturities, and I would imagine that in the world of PE, although a lot of family-owned businesses, privately owned capital is dominant in Asia, the PE world is still more embryonic. So how are you finding it, and how are you expecting it to develop?
So it's probably more advanced than people think. Basically, we have two countries in Asia with 1.4 billion people, China and India, each. So that's twice as much as Europe and the US combined, roughly. So big markets, big growth. China has had long growth, quickly disrupted right now, but general trend continues. India, strong growth. China is second largest private equity market globally, after the US, so clearly ahead of the UK or in Europe. India is an interesting market for us because the private equity market there has been significant in 2006, but not grown much since. First, because 2006 to 2010 was not as successful, also with FX devaluation. But the last decade, the last 10 years have been very strong, and the market is still in its early stages, but with strong growth potential. We are very focused on these two economies because they bring something to a portfolio that you can't have in the Western world. The Western world is a mature economy, not many unmet needs, whereas in India, there's huge unmet needs. As an example, we invested directly into Lenskart, which is the leading eyewear company in India. And just as an example, in India, we have 500 million people that need vision correction. Many of them don't have it. So the growth potential is just massive. And these are the elements that we want to tap into: the local demand, the unmet needs in these regions.
So let's just pause, because Lenskart I had a little bit about. We can all imagine the size of the potential market, but also the incredible complexities of a country that size with challenging infrastructure. Just tell me a little bit about at what stage you got involved with Lenskart and how the relationship and the profile has developed.
First and foremost, we were invested through a primary fund commitment with one of our local specialized GPs into that business in the very early financing rounds. And we could monitor the company grow and develop over the years until we had further follow-on financing rounds, where we then decided to participate also directly. A very good approach for us, where we have a broad universe of portfolio companies indirectly owned, and then can double down on the ones we want to at a later stage at the right time for us with regards to the risk return profile of the business.
And if you look ahead, how would you expect that relationship to continue, or the exit to occur?
The exit is likely IPO. Could also be a trade sale, but I would expect an IPO. And then we'll take our assessment when and how to sell.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come. But a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business, and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/LiveTrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintus. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintus is a new concept in art investing, giving investors the chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon and Basquiat. Actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintus and think it merits a closer look. Let's come back to Europe, because I think in the VC space you've invested in Revolut. We have had Martin Gilbert, former chairman of Aberdeen Standard and now chair of Revolut, on the Money Maze podcast. And again, just how did that investment come about? Just tell us a little bit about the relationship.
Most of our venture activity is really still US-centric, but Asia and Europe have gained in weight there. So basically, we've also invested into Revolut, similar to the Lenskart story that I just mentioned. We've been invested through multiple fund managers at the early stages of Revolut. And again, we could then assess for a later financing round an approach to invest directly. And we're happy to have done so and are now investing in one of these leading financial players of the new generation in the UK.
So when I listen to you and think about industries, we've talked about eyewear, we talk about financial services. I think you're also invested in dental clinics. How do you assess both where you want to be from a sector standpoint and where your skills are strongest?
We have a focus on five industry sectors, and that's the sequence of the weighting in our portfolio: healthcare, technology, consumer, business services, and industrials. That's all we do. Our whole portfolio is focused around those five, with local specialized managers forming part of our strong global network, and thus leveraging their expertise, but also applying our industry sector practice internally. So every investment professional is part of an industry sector practice group and is part of a local or regional segment team, like US buyout team, European buyout team, Asian growth team, etc. So we can play the whole industry sector expertise across our experience that we have through our 200 direct co-investments, roughly, as well as through our 5,000 indirect portfolio companies.
When I look at the track record, we've discussed some of the performance numbers of the PE firms that we've looked at over the last few years. I think I'm right in saying Schroders Capital have had a 23% IRR since 2010 in the private equity business, which is impressive. Tell us a little bit about how lumpy, how consistent, or how you feel about those returns.
It's been a great time and a strong performance indeed. We're very proud of that. We, of course, analyze the performance per segment, region, industry, etc. And what is amazing is how consistent this performance has been in our portfolio. So on the venture side versus the buyout side, on the regional Asia, US, Europe side, very consistent performance numbers. The last 10 years, of course, the venture has had a bit more tailwind through the strong emphasis on growth versus value. That has been the dominating factor of the last 10 years. But nobody knew that in 2010. So it was important to have done the investments at the time. So overall, very consistent performance across the segments and regions. Interestingly, and most important to me, is the outperformance over public, which is really what plays to the private equity promise. So better governance model and an outperformance for the illiquidity that the clients take with the asset allocation is what has been there for the long run and which has also been there throughout cycles in down markets as well as up markets. And especially when the market has more turmoil, private equity showed even more outperformance in our empiric evidence.
So I think that will nicely allow me to talk about the client base, but also about the wider geopolitical perspective, certainly political perspective towards PE. I mean, it probably was now over a decade that I think it was Peter Strzok of the SPD in Germany described private equity as locusts in an outburst that had obviously followed some PE transactions. But how do you think continental investors and industry owners today think about the world of PE?
I think private equity has had a reputational challenge, as all the capitalistic elements are always a bit in the negative press in many areas. Private equity as an industry has to do better in communication. The history of private equity has been it's private, therefore it's private. But I think that is changing. Also, the topic of sustainability is very important here. Basically, also requesting the private businesses to be more transparent about their contribution to the society. And I think that's where private equity has to do a much better job in communicating how the businesses that we back are adding value for the society and the planet. Overall, I think the innovativeness of business models within private equity will lead the crowd here again. From the venture side, we'll add innovation, and from the buyout side, we'll accelerate business practice changes for good for the society. And that needs to be better communicated with more transparency, with more KPIs and also data. Also, the job creation, which often was under the low-cost topic, was, of course, questioned. I think private equity has clearly proven to be a job creator of quality.
So I want to stop on that ESG and sustainability. I was lucky enough to interview Sir Chris Hone, first of all, on the podcast a year ago, but very recently at the London Value Investor Conference. And his criticism is that the world of PE is opaque and less accountable. And clearly his focus is on the whole say on climate and the energy transition. But how do you think the world of PE does make itself less opaque?
Basically, as I said, coming from a defensive position of not being fully transparent about what we invest in for the reason that it is private, but that's changing. Some regulation is also driving that. Some makes a lot of sense, some makes a bit less sense from the regulation side, but basically the private equity industry will report more about their businesses. It will be transparent to its investors. It has always been transparent to its investors, less to the public. But the larger the private equity market gets, the larger the individual private equity businesses are, the more the transparency is following. So there's a lot of effort that I see for the ESG development for ourselves. We have been a very early signatory of the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investing, really advocating more ESG practice through the value chain in the underlying companies. We have an A-plus rating, which is the highest rating that you can have for our private equity practice. We are part of Schroders, which has a high emphasis on the whole sustainability topic and also the climate change. We're one of the Net Zero 2050 subscribers, meaning that we want to have a portfolio of all the assets, public, listed, and illiquid, by 2050 with a net zero carbon emission. It's a big journey. We are at the starting point. While, by the way, as a physicist, I did some climate change research on ice cores 30 years ago, which already showed the heating of the planet. So now we're there again from the capital market.
Schroders, obviously, its history was in public markets, strong franchise growing in the private assets. What edge do you think you have with Schroders as the organization behind you?
One is that regulation becomes more and more demanding. in general, on a per country, per client type perspective, which helps to be part of a large organization that has the resources to deal with that. A second thing is, that's a very important topic, is what we call the democratization of private equity or private assets in general, which means making private equity accessible to smaller investors that have so far not been able to access the asset class. And that is a very high strength of Schroders to develop products that are accessible for more the wealth management or ultimately, hopefully, also the retail market for offering the private equity investment approach to all the clients.
Very broadly, the illiquidity that is associated with the function of private equity, of course, makes institutional investors with long-term capital commitments more logical partners. How do you think about the retail world being more invested in PE?
There's new product initiatives and ideas that have already started to be available, also from our side. For example, our semi-liquid, which means you have almost normal mutual fund experience with regards to you subscribe to the fund, you're invested in a fully developed portfolio. So you don't have capital calls and commitments like in the limited partnership concept of private equity, and you can exit every quarter. That's the typical semi-liquid fund. There is some restrictions to this liquidity. So you can't get out if everybody wants to get out. But if you want to get out for your personal private reasons, and this is not within the macro crisis, then you'll have your liquidity. And that makes the entry barrier for smaller investors and with smaller amounts possible. So that's just one example. There's also other products that are being established where just the ticket sizes get much smaller, and therefore the affordability to park some of the assets or the wealth in a less liquid format is then easier to pursue.
One of the things that we've come back to as we've gone through this private equity series is that we know that the Western markets, particularly I'm going to look at the European and the UK, have been increasingly shunned by investors in terms of the number of listings, in terms of the research coverage. And that, of course, has given private equity a boost because many, I suppose, CEOs and shareholders are feeling unloved and not able to maximize valuation. How do you think this public and private journey evolves?
The positive perspective is that both exist, both have a good proposition. Private has advanced, especially because capital is available in private. You don't need to be listed to get access to funding, neither on the debt side nor for equity. Many companies that have a long-term plan and are long-term oriented with their innovation, they don't want to be caught in the quarterly reporting cycles. And that makes the private equity proposition preferred on that side, at least. Whereas for the very large businesses, public is definitely still the place to be for its overall liquidity. The coexistence of both, private can still earn a few points of market share from public. And definitely that's what we've been seeing so far with the private equity market growth. Venture capital companies staying private for longer, but also that must be addressed at some point. So there must be some opportunities to get liquidity again. So the journey is on. It will continue. There's room for both coexisting models and justifications for both models, depending on the situation.
So you've had lots of successes, but the investment journey is littered with the things that haven't worked and the lessons that one takes away from that. Maybe just talk a little bit about, as you reflect on the years you've been in this, where you've made mistakes and particularly what that has done to change your process.
We do lots of investments. Of course, not all of them work out well, but what we've learned is basically if you have a good base case investment scenario and you have an upside case, which is really driven by transformation from within the company, then you'll have decent success rate of that transformation working out. And when it doesn't, you're still okay. With that approach of having an upside case that is really driven through change and a good base case, we've experienced a very, very good performance for a portfolio construction perspective. Now, for my personal anecdotal, history when I was an associate in the very early years. I had the opportunity to evaluate a secondary transaction which had Google in it, of course, pre-IPO, and unfortunately, we felt we shouldn't pay up and passed. So would have been a great success. At the same time, Google got exited far too early from the private portfolios, the venture portfolios, into the public space, if you look at it from today's perspective.
I'd just like to close with a few general questions, and I think you might be our first mountaineer, who's also the first Swiss, who's also the first PhD in physics. But if you have a few days off, where do you want to be? Is it halfway up a mountain? Tell me a little bit about what for you gives you the greatest pleasure.
Yes, I love the mountains. And basically, I think what the mountains give you is they help you to be humble. And humble is a good thing also for the investment practice. In the mountains, you're small, you're dependent on the weather condition and so forth. And that gives me a good feeling and I enjoy the nature. Similar experience in the desert, similar experience on the sea. Whenever you feel exposed to something bigger, that's what I enjoy, nature, feeling small in a big world with lots of things to discover.
Well, I don't know whether you've watched the series on Netflix called 14 Peaks. It was sponsored by Bremont, and Bremont is a sponsor of our show, and Nims Purja, the Nepalese climber, climbs the 14 great peaks over 8,000 meters in a record time, beating Reinhold Messner by some margin. So I don't know whether you watched it, but it's absolutely terrific. What is the highest peak you've climbed?
I've climbed the Chimborazo in Ecuador as my highest at 6,300, but I've also climbed all the Swiss mountains that are higher than 4,000 meters, and that's my personal pride in a way, but it took me 40 years, right?
Well,
so no record time.
Because you're here and we're talking about Switzerland, I was intrigued because, as we know, Europe's dealing with this immense energy shock, and I was surprised that actually 75% of Switzerland's energy comes from a mixture of predominantly hydroelectric, but also nuclear. Do the Swiss right now feel in some way insulated from these inflationary pressures?
Swiss inflation is pretty low, 2.5%. And basically these 2.5% are spread across three equal parts. One third is energy cost-driven, one-third is supply chain issue-driven, and one-third is regular inflation. So we're pretty normal. We're where we would want to be. Of course, it's strengthening of the currency in the long run that has helped to have the inflation low. But on the energy side, while our energy sources locally are very clean already from a carbon emission point of view, and also therefore less dependent on foreign supply, we are still part of the European power grid, which has its complexities to come.
Although we don't want to get political, Switzerland has to manage this delicate balance of not being part of the EU and yet being surrounded by EU and having to manage that tension. How do you feel generally the Swiss people regard the EU structure and their relationship with it?
Swiss people want to be independent. In a sense, that's hindering us from getting stronger ties or joining the EU for sure. There's always efforts and there's also a meaningful minority that would want to be closer to the EU. But the historic economic development, but also overall development has been very strong as an independent country. And I think that opinion that is a strength in itself still prevails. We are definitely funding lots of EU activities and are a capital source for the EU in general, the political contributions that make us a good partner. And I think that's very important also for our own welfare.
So two closing questions. We have a really valuable cohort of young people listening to the Money Maze podcast who not only learn, but helps them shape their ideas about their own careers. You're the physicist who switched to finance. Tell me a little bit about what advice you would give to young people asking you about career choices.
There's two things. First, maintain a high level of intellectual curiosity. That always helps. And secondly, do something that you are passionate about. That's the two things that I would recommend. And then success may follow if everything goes well and if at some point your market takes off. If you want to do biotech, it may take 15 years, but suddenly you're in the limelight.
And finally, what would be your favorite book?
Honestly, I'm pretty scientific.
That's okay.
I enjoyed just my last book that I read from Bill Gates, How to Avoid the Climate Disaster. I found it a very good summary book of the big picture, bringing it down to what does it all take to address the climate change requirements that we have as a society for our planet.
Well, look, Rainer, that's been a really interesting conversation. I'm going to take away a couple of things, which is that at the lower market value segment in which you operate, there is much more noticeable inefficiency, and that inefficiency in your mind continues to create more opportunity, and that the European landscape for PE is perhaps in some ways more advanced than many would think, and the public acceptance of it is growing, but the requirement for greater disclosure is absolutely essential, and we should expect to see more of that. And I didn't mention one thing that really surprised me, is that the Swiss eat more chocolate than any other nation in the world at 11.3 kilograms per year.
I eat chocolate for breakfast, 40 grams every day for the last 30 years. So I'm the statistical driver.
I can't leave it without you explaining why.
Well, I just love it.
Well, the world is full of surprises. That's another one. So thank you so much for being with the Money Myths podcast today. We'll look forward to seeing you maybe one day in Zurich.
Thank you, Simon. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.